Okay, good evening, everyone. Nice to see you all. Are you all well? All settled in? Got a room? Anyone who hasn't got a room? That would be very cold for you if you haven't got a room. Again, it's serious trouble. Good, so nice to see you all here. This is one of those usual retreats that I do. We're going to look at the suttas, of course. This is kind of just what I do whenever I teach a retreat anywhere. It's always about the suttas. The idea behind this is to combine the suttas with meditation, get some inspiration from the Buddha, and then the idea is through that inspiration to make a meditation go better as a consequence. So that is the idea behind this. See if I can get this to work properly. The theme for the retreat this year is to practice like the Buddha to be. In other words, we're going to look at the Buddha before his awakening to see what he did to achieve awakening and see if we can follow in the footsteps of the Buddha. I don't know about you, but I find it always very inspiring to read the suttas where the Buddha talks about his own practice. He says, this is what I did. And of course, the idea is that if he did that, we should be doing the same thing. That's kind of the feeling when you read those suttas, that we are supposed to follow in those footsteps. I've always found that some of those suttas are some of the most inspiring suttas in the entire Pali Canon. And it's inspiring for a number of reasons. One, because the Buddha gives a lot of detail about he practiced, how he did things. And sometimes those details are different from what you find in other suttas. It's also inspiring because these suttas, they kind of get to know the Buddha a little bit. You get a feeling for who the Buddha was as a person. You get closer to the Buddha. You get a kind of sense for who this teacher actually was, who lived 2,500 years ago in a foreign culture. It seems like very far away. And so it's useful to get a feeling for the kind of the person behind these suttas. Who was this person? And when you get a feeling for that, it brings you closer to the Buddha, to the Dhamma, to the practice, to everything really. And this is obviously, this is actually a very important part of the practice, having a sense for the Buddha and what he was all about. So this is the reason for this. The way that the suttas are structured, it may not have been obvious to you. You may have had a look at them. There is actually a structure. Believe it or not, there's a structure there. It may not seem that way. The structure basically is that the beginning of the retreat is going to be concerned about with right view, how to look at the world, how to think about the world from a Buddhist perspective. And from that right view really arises the rest of the Buddhist path. There comes some right view. Right view is the foundation for everything else. And so get right view right. Don't get right view wrong, then you have a problem. Get right view right, then there is a chance we're going to be able to make some progress in this practice. And the rest of the suttas are about the rest of the path, with an emphasis on right action, right effort, right mindfulness, and then a little bit of right samadhi towards the very end. So that is what this is all about. So whether you approve or not, and now you are here, you're stuck, you're going to be here for 9 days, you're going to have to deal with it. But I'm sure you will enjoy it as we go along. And if you don't, that's kind of the way things are sometimes, and just have to find, make the best of it. So the idea of any meditation retreat or any sutta retreat or whatever you want to call it is to come here and have a good time, to enjoy yourself. The spiritual path should be always be something that is enjoyable, something that where you feel more relaxed, more at ease, maybe a sense of joy, all of these positive things. That is the purpose of practicing a spiritual path, and that is also the purpose of being on a meditation retreat. And this is a very good kind of guideline for you. Yeah, are you enjoying it or are you hating it? Yeah, and if you are hating it, you need to make some adjustments. And if you are enjoying it, then you know you are on the right track. It's always a very good guideline for all of these retreats. So keep that at the back of your mind. And if you're not enjoying it, if one day things are not going so well, then try to adjust a little bit. Do something which brings back the sense of well-being, the sense of ease, the sense of comfort, the sense of joy even in the practice. And then kind of things come back again. This is always a good kind of benchmark for deciding whether you are on the right track or not. So one of the fundamental purposes of this kind of practice. Before we do anything else, I'm just going to very briefly explain to you the eight precepts. Is anyone here who doesn't know what the eight precepts are? Is anyone who completely had no idea what these things are? Everyone knows. Yeah, okay. Well, that's pretty good. Okay, well done. Well-educated group of Buddhists, so that's good. Is anyone who is meditating here on the retreat for the first time? For the first time? Okay, welcome. Very good. Excellent. But you know the eight precepts, is that right? So that's good. In that case, I'm not going to talk about it, because if you all know it already, we're not going to waste any... Actually, that's the wrong word, wasting time. We're not going to spend any time on that, because you're already aware of what is going on, which is wonderful. Tonight, I'm not going to talk about any of the suttas specifically for this retreat. I'm going to start off just by talking in general about meditation practice. This is what I usually do on this retreat, spend the first evening talking about meditation, and then the rest of the retreat will be about the suttas, and the meditation will kind of be reinforced just through the guided meditations that we do in the evening. That's kind of the idea, so that you have kind of the background today, and then that is reinforced in the evenings every day. And the rest of this time is going to be focused on explaining the suttas. And of course, there will be things about meditation there as well, but not maybe as, not kind of the basic ideas that are required for the meditation to work. So let's talk a little bit about meditation practice. On the Buddhist path, the most important meditation, I would say, that you find in the suttas is the mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati. I say that for a number of reasons. Main reason, because it's explained in many places in the suttas. You find it in different contexts, to different groups of people. The Anapanasati Sutta, the main discourse on the mindfulness of breathing, it starts off by saying that all of these great people, the great arahants of the old days, they're all assembled together. Venerable Sariputta is there, Venerable Mahamoggallana is there, Venerable Ananda is there, Venerable Mahakachana is there, Venerable Revata is there. These are all the great arahants of the time of the Buddha. They all come together, and when they all come together, that is when the Buddha delivers this discourse. So it must be pretty important, right, if all of these great monks are there. And that's kind of one of the ways in which you know that something must have been very significant, the context in which it appears. So Anapanasati seems to be one of the, I think, the most important way that meditation is explained in the suttas. Another reason for this is because the Buddha specifically says in the suttas that when you practice the mindfulness of breathing, you fulfill the four satipatthanas, the four mindfulness meditations, as it is sometimes translated. Satipatthana, often considered one of the fundamental ways as well of talking about meditation practice. All of that is fulfilled simply by watching the breath. Breath meditation is all that it takes. And then the Buddha says the seven factors of awakening. And these are the things that lead to the awakening experiences. That too is fulfilled by breath meditation. And then the last thing he says is that vijja and vimutti. Vijja and vimutti is knowledge and liberation. That too is fulfilled by breath meditation. It's kind of extraordinary, yeah, this breath that we always carry with us, that is always here, always present in a way that we never really pay attention to. But if it isn't there, we are in serious trouble, so we know it's there somehow, yeah, hopefully. Yeah, still there. Okay, good. Just checking, just in case. I might be in serious trouble otherwise. So, Venerable Ananda, if you see some serious trouble, then you know what to do. Yeah. So, so this humble breath, yeah, that is always there. We never really pay attention to it. This breath takes you all the way to awakening. Yeah. That's kind of extraordinary. Yeah. There's nothing fancy. Yeah. There's no need for any kind of, you know, wild imaginations or these kind of things or fantasies or whatever. It's very down to earth, very simple. And this is one of the things that I always found so fascinating with the teachings of the Buddha, is that they tend to be very down to earth, very practical, very grounding, nothing fancy. If all you have to do is watch the breath, it takes you all the way to awakening. There's something very reassuring about that, a sense that it's you know, something that you're not really being taken for any kind of you're not being taken anywhere weird, because there's nothing weird you're doing. You're just staying with those very simple things that are always with us, the breath. There's something very beautiful to me about the breath meditation. And importantly, it is also the meditation that the Buddha himself used for awakening. This is found in the Anapanasati Sanghita, the Connected Discourses on Mindfulness of Breathing, where the Buddha says he also used mindfulness of breathing to reach awakening itself. We're going to come back to this later on during this retreat. Very useful, very grounding, very simple technique of meditation. So this is what I want to focus on just for today, how to make the most of this mindfulness of breathing here, how we can actually get into this meditation. It sounds very simple on the surface, but actually getting it right actually is not always very easy. And you will probably find during this retreat that sometimes you have success, and sometimes actually it's quite hard to follow the breath. It's hard to get those results that are promised in the Anapanasati Sutta. Yeah, the joy, the happiness, the stillness, and all of these kind of things that we are supposed to achieve. Actually, it is not always so. It doesn't happen automatically always. We're going to have to find out why it doesn't happen, how we can make it happen. What is this meditation all about? One of the kind of really difficult things is actually knowing how to observe the breath. This is actually one of the hardest things of all. Sometimes we talk about this particular meditation on the breath, we talk about it as watching the breath. We talk about it maybe as focusing on the breath, paying attention to the breath. These are various words that we often use for this mindfulness of breathing meditation. Now, all of these words are slightly unfortunate. None of them are really kind of really gets to the idea of what mindfulness of breathing really is about. And the problem is that if you say watching the breath, what you are doing there is that you are placing your attention on the breath. It's like you're using a bit of willpower. You say, now I'm going to place my attention on the breath. Or if you say, I'm going to focus on the breath, it's the same idea again. It's the idea of putting your attention on the breath. But the weird thing is, this is already kind of problematic. For you, it may seem very kind of, that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? But no, actually, this is already problematic. And the reason it is problematic is because this is not really how this is taught in the suttas. So one of the suttas that I always bring up during a meditation retreat is not included in the suttas that we have here, but it's included in my mind, so you're going to get it anyway, whether you want to or not. I'm going to talk about lots of suttas probably that are not included in these pages, because this is just, you know, par for the course when you teach a sutta retreat. Many of you will have heard this sutta many, many times before, because I bring it up on every retreat that I teach. And this is this idea that when you do meditation, when you meditate, there is no will required for the meditation. The Buddha specifically says, he uses these particular words in the Pali, he says, na Chetanaya Karaniya. Na is not, Karaniya to be done, not to be done. What is not to be done? Chetana, Chetanaya. Chetana is the Pali word for intention, is the Pali word for will, is the Pali word for applying the mind in a certain way. So it literally says, Chetana, will, yeah, applying the mind is not to be done. That's quite literally what it says. And so this gives you an idea that the moment we say watching the breath, attending to the breath, focusing on the breath, we're already getting it wrong. Why? Because we're already using chetana. We're already using the will to apply the mind onto the object. Now it's kind of a, it's an interesting point, this idea of na, chetanaya, karaniya, because if you read certain translators, they will typically, the translation is that there is no need for intention, or there's no need for the will, or no need for volition, is a typical translation for this phrase. But actually, it is not a good translation. And I want to tell off my good friend Bhante Sujato for not getting this right, because he ought to know better. Please don't tell him I said this, because I'm not sure if he would like that. But but it's true, because this idea of need, there's no need to use will. It sort of implies, well, maybe you can use it, but actually you don't need it. It's not strong enough. It doesn't actually get to the idea what the Pali is about. It actually says the will is not to be done. Yeah, the will is a problem. That's basically what it is saying. And in the next phrase, it says that this development of meditation, or the evolution of meditation, happens according to nature. It is dhammata, dhamma. The Pali word dhamma means according to nature, according to lawfulness, according to the way things develop naturally. And if certain things develop naturally, if you try to use the willpower on something that is supposed to develop naturally, you have a problem. Yeah, you're trying to hurry up nature. You cannot hurry up nature. Ajahn Brahm has this beautiful simile of a little child who wants to hurry up the plant growing. The little plant is growing, and the little child says, "Mummy, the plant is growing so slowly." Mummy says, "Okay, wait, just be patient, water the plant every day, and it will grow." And after a while, the child just can't stand anymore and decides to help the plant in growing. "I'm going to help the plant." Okay, pulling, pulling, pulling. Bang, plant is gone. If you pull the breath, same problem, right? If you try to pull the breath to make the mindfulness happen, to make the watching, the attentiveness, the focus happen, exactly the same problem. You destroy the nature of things. It happens according to nature. So this is the idea of being able to not be involved in the breath, right? And it is right there in one of these very fundamental suttas on the nature of meditation practice. Then you go to the Anapanasati Sutta that I've just been talking about, which is the main exposition of mindfulness of breathing. And there too, it says that, the Pali says, it says, sattova asasati, satto pasasati. Breathing mindful, you breathe in. Or just mindful, you breathe in. Mindful, you breathe out. Mindful, you breathe in. Mindful, you breathe out. It doesn't say anything about watching the breath. It doesn't say anything about focusing on the breath. It just says that you are mindful, and while you are mindful, you breathe. Yeah, well, you don't have a choice. You have to breathe anyway, so that's kind of fine. But so you are just mindful, and then the breathing happens. And when you are mindful, and the breath is there, that is when you're doing mindfulness of breathing. Yeah, it's so simple. But again, nothing about forcing your attention onto the breath or anything like that. You just have mindfulness and the breathing happens. And this is all, I think, very interesting. And it shows us how easy it is to go wrong with this idea of mindfulness of breathing. The vast majority of people, they will watch the breath. They will focus on the breath. They will attend to the breath. You sit down and the breath is there. Okay, focus on the breath. And the moment you do that, guaranteed that you are using willpower to do that. And the moment you are using willpower, the process is not happening according to nature as it should be doing. Now, we're just discussing this with Ajahn Brahm yesterday, because I am one of those monks who really kind of love to kind of go up and bug Ajahn Brahm a little bit, you know, and ask him questions and kind of draw out the meaning of of whatever. And that's good fun. I really recommend it if you want to kind of, you know, get some, I think sometimes people don't understand the amount of wisdom in someone like Ajahn Brahm. So go to him and bug him, right? If you do that, ask him some good questions, and you get some very interesting answers. This is what I do. And I always found it very fascinating to do this with Ajahn Brahm, because he says the unexpected. And I love to hear the unexpected, because that's where you grow. That's where you have a chance of kind of moving forward, in a sense. So I'm not sure if I should say these things. Am I saying? I think Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm may not be happy with me if he hears about this, but hopefully this will not go beyond this room. Actually, he probably will, won't it? Okay, well, too late. Anyway, I'm sure he will forgive me. So, so we were discussing this whole idea about mindfulness of breathing, yeah? And I was saying to him, I think all of this idea of focusing and attention, all of this is really wrong. And he said, yes, you've got it, you understand. And the idea is really more like being with the breath. That is the right way of thinking about meditation. So that because you are present, yeah, because you are mindful, because mindfulness, and one of the things that is present when you're mindful, the breath is always there. The breath is always around. So if you really are mindful and you just wait, the breath will come by itself, because the breath is here, and mindfulness means to be in the present. Yeah, you don't actually need to attend to the breath. As long as you are mindful, you are okay. That's really all you have to do. And then you are with the breath. You exist together with the breath, and the breath just happens. There's no holding on to the breath. So why then do we hold on to the breath? Why do we attend to the breath in the way that we normally do? And I think a main reason why we do that is because we are afraid of losing the breath. Yeah, if you are just mindful and the breath is there with you like a companion on the path, it feels like the breath can disappear at any time. It's only by focusing on it deliberately that gives you a sense of control. It gives you a sense that you and the breath, you are kind of ensuring that the breath is there by focusing on it. But if you don't focus, if all you're doing is being mindful, well, you can lose the breath at any time. And that's kind of, you don't want to lose the breath, right? Because you want to do breath meditation. Wrong. You want to lose the breath. That's the whole point. You want it to be so easy, so natural, just mindful, that the breath actually can disappear at any time. It is okay. And then when the breath is gone, you just wait. Mindfulness is there, you wait, and then the breath comes back again soon enough. And this is the natural way of doing breath meditation. Just being present, just being aware, just being mindful, and waiting for the breath, and then going with the breath as a good friend, traveling with the breath in meditation as you walk with a friend on the path. If you walk with a friend on the path, you don't pay attention to the friend. You don't focus on the friend. You just know the friend is there. In the same way, you know the breath is there without the focusing, without actually doing anything deliberate. This is the idea of mindfulness of breathing here. And it's very different from how normally these things are, from often how these things are explained. And this I take from Ajahn Brahm. I'm not really saying anything, you know, everything I usually say is from Ajahn Brahm. I don't say anything new. Just the same, you know, I've been brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm. I have no choice. The brainwashing comes out of my mouth, and that's, then you get brainwashed by Ajahn Brahm also through my mouth. And then Ajahn Brahm was brainwashed by Ajahn Shah, and he goes back all the way to the Buddha, and ultimately we're all brainwashed by the Buddha. So this is what's happening on this retreat. You're getting brainwashed by the Buddha. If you don't want to get brainwashed by the Buddha, you're in trouble. This is going to happen on this retreat, whether you want to or not. So this is the first part of it, yeah? The idea of mindfulness of breathing. So I hope that makes sense to you. But of course, if you know that, all you have to do is to be mindful. And then when you're mindful, the breath will be there. Then the next question is, well, how can we achieve that kind of mindfulness? Because the mindfulness has to be quite strong, right? If you're going to be able just to sit there and the breath is going to be your companion, how can you possibly be mindful in this way? And there are two things, two aspects of meditation that kind of enables the meditation process to work. And one aspect is the idea of peace. Yeah, being peaceful, allowing things to be, just sitting back, not doing anything. This is one aspect of meditation. The other aspect, and of course, as the meditation develops, the idea is that this peace is supposed to be deeper and deeper and deeper as you move along in meditation. Point one. Second thing that gives you an indication of whether your meditation is working or not is whether you are enjoying it. Are you experiencing deeper and deeper senses of ease, of enjoyment, of joy, of happiness, and all of these kind of things? And if you are, again, you know the meditation is working here. These are two of the main pointers, or hallmarks, if you like, of meditation and of the deepening of meditation as you go along. The sense of peace that you have and the sense of happiness and joy that you have. Yeah. So let's start with the idea of being peaceful and being tranquil. How can we make this happen in the meditation so that mindfulness comes about? And then when mindfulness comes about, then we can just be with the breath, as the breath, as if it is a friend or something like that. And the starting point here, and this kind of comes back to the Buddhist idea of the middle way of practice. We talk a lot about the middle way. And the most important part of the middle way is the idea to avoid torturing ourselves. Yeah, this is such an important thing, because if you torture yourself, it's very, very difficult to really be mindful. Yeah, or you will be mindful maybe, but all you'll be mindful of is of the pain that you have in your legs or your back or wherever it might be. So please don't do that. We want to have a mind that is at ease. Yeah, a mind which is relaxed, which can enjoy the peace, and which doesn't kind of get upset because of pain or whatever. So one of the first things to do is to avoid pain in meditation. This is very different, again, from what sometimes people get told on meditation retreats. Sometimes we get told that actually when you have pain, you should just watch the pain. And I don't recommend that. And I think there is very little evidence that this actually is what the Buddha wants us to do. There's very little evidence for this in the suttas. And again, why? Well, the reason why, because when the Buddha explains meditation, it is always about happy states of mind, peaceful states of mind. Pain doesn't really come into it. Yes, we need to understand pain, but the understanding of pain is very different from the experience of pain. You can understand pain without experiencing it, and this is kind of the point here. So please don't get this wrong. Please don't sit too much, too long in the painful postures, because all it will do is it will turn you away from meditation practice. It's a beautiful practice with so much potential. So much potential for improving the quality of your life, to understanding the nature of your mind and body in entirely new ways. And that potential might get destroyed if we tackle the meditation in the wrong way, if you experience too much pain, too much displeasure, and these kind of things. So it's a very simple piece of advice, yeah, but it just basically means that you sit in a posture that is reasonably comfortable. Yeah, you can sit in whatever way you like. It doesn't matter. You can use as many cushions as you like. You can lean against the wall if you want to. You can use little stools. I don't think there is any kind of implement that is forbidden here at Dharma Grove. I think you can use whatever implement you have. So if you have some kind of fancy, newfangled implement that hasn't been seen before, then please use it. And we will admire your implement, meditation implement, when we see it. So please sit in any way you like. We have these beautiful chairs here, and these chairs are generally quite conducive for meditation. They are stable and solid, and they are very useful. So don't necessarily sit in one posture all the time. Move around a little bit, yeah? Is that allowed, Lehar, to move around? Yeah, it's allowed, okay. So it's not like you have your chair and that's kind of it. You're allowed to move around a bit. Good. And then you will find that balance in the body where you don't have too much problems, where pain is actually not the thing that stops you. Yeah, this is the first way of achieving peace in meditation. Without that, it is much more difficult to find peace and tranquility. So find that place where the body is no longer a problem, yeah, where you are at ease, and you are kind of, you allow yourself to enjoy what is happening here. And the second thing, once the body is relatively at ease, is also to learn to relax, yeah, to let go of the tensions and the stresses of ordinary life, and to really relax in a very deep way. This is kind of the second thing here that we have to try to do. So how do we do this? How do we allow ourselves to relax? And how do we allow ourselves not to get involved in the meditation object, in the process, by using too much willpower? How can we do that? And to do this, it is useful to have some similes that explain these ideas. And one of the similes that a number of ways of doing this, but one of the similes that I sometimes use is the idea of sitting in a nice armchair after work. Yeah, what is it? In other words, what does it mean not to do anything? Yeah. And it is similarly, you can imagine you come home from work, you've been working really hard, and you are probably tired because of all the concentration and the focus that you have to do at work. You have to write things and read things and go to meetings and all these kind of things. And then you come back home, and when you come back home, you're tired. What do? You sit down in your favorite armchair, or maybe you lie down on your bed or whatever for a while. And when you are tired and you sit down, what do you do? You don't do anything, right? When you sit down in your armchair, you lie down on your bed because you're tired, you don't do anything at all. You allow things to flow. You don't say, oh, relax, relax, or anything like that. You just allow things to be. That's the kind of the point of being tired. Yeah, you don't actually guide your mind. You don't force yourself to do anything. And this is similar to meditation practice. Yeah, you don't force yourself in one way or another. You just allow the mind to flow. And the strange thing is that if you allow the mind to flow without doing anything, without forcing it one way or another, after a while, the energy starts to come back. Yeah, it is like when you sit down in your armchair, you're really tired, and after a while, you feel the energy returning again. And when the energy returns, well, then you can kind of get up and you can continue with whatever activities you're supposed to. So all you're doing is sitting down, allowing things to flow. In other words, not doing anything at all, really. That is where energy comes from, because it is the act of volition, the act of willing things, the doing of the mind. That is what depletes the mind from energy in the first place. So by allowing things to flow, you're doing much less than before, and allows the energy to return to the mind as a consequence. So you're just sitting there, not doing anything. This is what it means not to do anything. It's like that armchair after work, when you lie down on your bed after work. That is really what it is kind of is getting at. Of course, you don't get up after a while, you carry on, but it gives an idea of the meaning of not doing anything here. Another simile that sometimes you might want to use is the idea of watching something like a sunset. Watching something beautiful, whatever it might be. Let's just take a sunset. Most people consider sunsets to be beautiful. If you don't like sunsets, then don't worry about this particular simile. If you hate sunsets, I think they're really terrible, then you have to find another simile for you. But since most people seem to like them, we'll use that as a simile. So what do you do when you're watching a sunset? Do you say, watch, watch, attend, focus? You don't, right? That kind of destroys the fun of the sunset. If you kind of force yourself to watch, that kind of messes up the whole experience of seeing the sun go down. Yes, and it's exactly the same thing with the breath. If you force your mind onto the breath, you mess up the joy that actually is there in the mindfulness of breathing. And exactly the same thing as if you force yourself to watch the sun setting here. So instead of forcing yourself, when you watch the sunset, you're normally relaxed. Yeah, you just sit there, you watch, and maybe your mind wanders a little bit and it comes back again. Or maybe you see something else, it comes back to the sun. But it comes back to the idea of the sunset all the time. Until eventually it is finished. Then, of course, you get up and you do something else. So the idea of a sunset, the difference between that and the armchair simile, is that a sunset also tends to be beautiful. And because it tends to be beautiful, it draws your mind towards that object. And this gives you an idea of why it is relatively easy to be with the sunset without deliberately focusing, because your mind is drawn towards it. Whether you want to or not, you're going to be able to see that sunset. And this is the same thing as it is with the breath meditation. The idea with the breath meditation is to make the breath attractive, to make the breath beautiful, to make the breath somewhere where the mind wants to go by itself. And if the mind goes there by itself, then again, there's no need for you to focus, to attend, or to watch deliberately, because the mind actually wants to be there, just as it is with the sunset. This is a second way of thinking about meditation, how to make it easy without deliberate effort, yet enjoying what is going on. So then you can really relax, you can be with things. There are more ways of many, many, you can probably make up endless number of similes with this. But one of the other ways that you may want to try out during this retreat, and that is to use the idea of death in your meditation. Because one of the things that you will find is that if you do a death contemplation and you do it in the right way, it is very similar to meditation practice. Dying and meditation are very similar to each other. So if you meditate, you don't know exactly what's going to happen. It's a bit uncertain. Death and meditation are very similar to each other. So why is that? Well, because if you are on your deathbed, you have to let go, right? There's not much choice. And what happens if someone is ready to die, if someone has been living a good life? Well, that is exactly what happens. And because they know that they have no choice but letting go of this world or whatever it is in this world that they are attached to, because they know that, they often become very peaceful. So a person who has lived a good life, who has been practicing well and doing whatever, they are peaceful when they die because they automatically let go. And not only do they automatically let go, but they also tend to have a sense of awareness. They are present and they're letting go at the same time. And this is kind of quite difficult to achieve very often. Very often when you think that you are letting go, you may fall asleep. This is kind of a very common thing. You get tired. Or if you use too much willpower, then you get restless and the mind isn't really, mind gets agitated. So there's a kind of a swinging between being restless and having tiredness in the mind. Back and forth. Either you are tired and lethargic or you're restless. But what we want to do is find that middle way where the mind is neither restless nor is it lethargic or tired. And that is what happens on your deathbed. You have clarity, but you also are peaceful. And the reason is because you know that you have to let go. You have no choice in the matter. And so what we want to do is we want to bring that idea into our meditation practice. So instead of waiting till you actually are going to die, die now, right? Die a little bit now. Are you ready to die? This is kind of the question. This is the old question that the monks got when they came to good monasteries in Thailand, like Wat Pa Pong. And then Ajahn Chah would say, "This is just—I don't know if this is true. But this is the story anyway." Ajahn Chah would say, "Have you come here to die?" And the monks would say, "What? What are you talking about? Come here to die?" And of course, the idea is like a metaphorical dying, the dying of the ego, maybe, or the dying in the sense of letting things go a little bit. That's kind of the idea. It wasn't, you're not literally going to die, or maybe you're literally going to die as well, but that wasn't really the intention behind that. So have you come here to die? And this is kind of also a little bit true right here. So have you come here to do the death contemplation? And if you do it in the right way, you will find that you are able to let go. And when you are able to let go in this way, you bring that into your meditation, and your meditation becomes peaceful as a consequence. Because letting go is hard. How do we let go? We need this little kind of extra things to lean on to allow the letting go to happen. So you bring the idea of death into the present. Am I? When am I going to die? Death is uncertain. maybe I will die soon. We just don't know when we're going to die. And if you're going to die soon, what does that mean to you? And if you get this right, and the Buddha says the closer the idea of death comes to you, if you're going to die tomorrow, for example, it becomes much more powerful. If you're going to die in your next breath, it becomes very powerful, right? And what that means, of course, is that you start to let go also right here, right now. Bring that into your meditation because you feel peaceful right there and then. Then you have a foundation for meditation practice. So there's also another benefit from this, right? If you are able to practice meditation and you're able to let go, it also means that you are readying yourself for dying itself. Because if you're able to learn to let go through meditation practice, it means that you also have an understanding of the process of dying. The process of dying is similar because it is all about letting go. Yeah, and actually, that is very beautiful and very helpful. Because if death is like meditation, you understand that death is not all that scary. Yeah, maybe death is even pleasant. It really depends on how you have lived your life. But if you have lived your life well and you're able to gain some peace, some happiness in your meditation, you have some idea of what the death experience is like. And if death is like this, you wonder, why on earth was I afraid of death? Death is really cool. Yeah, and you're kind of ready to die. Yeah, so if it's going to happen, okay, you're fine. If it doesn't happen, well, even better, because we can do some more meditation. It's not as if we are seeking to die, but at least we start to feel at ease with it. There's a double advantage. On the one hand, you can use death to aid your meditation, and then when your meditation is successful, you have an idea of what the dying is about also. So both sides here are kind of building up a positive perception that has a double benefit for your practice, if you like. Yeah. So this is how you can learn to be at peace, yeah? Not trying so hard, using some very simple perceptions of what it means just to let go, just allowing things to be. And as you do that, you will start to see your mindfulness becomes more sharp. And when the mindfulness sharpens in this way, this is actually what allows the mind then to be with the breath. Not focusing on the breath, not attending on the breath, not even watching the breath, but being with the breath, just as you are with a friend or something like that. This is kind of the idea here. Yeah, and this is how this kind of comes about fairly naturally. So this is the peace side of things. Another very important part of this is the idea of right view. Because one of the problems with life is that when you have wrong view, we value the wrong kind of things. Wrong view and our values is very, very closely related to each other. If you have wrong view, it means you value those things in the world that lead to problems. This is kind of the whole point. Having right view means that you can move towards happiness. Wrong view means you move towards suffering. So when you have wrong view, you value the wrong things. And because you value the wrong things, your priorities are all wrong. And you do things that doesn't actually get you anywhere. But if you have a right view, you value the right things. You value those things that actually lead to happiness. And because you value things that lead to happiness, you prioritize those. And this is what then guides you in your meditation practice. So right view is incredibly important. Not only is it important as a foundation for the entire path of practice, but it's also incredibly important for your ability to meditate here and now. So if you are as able, and this is why we're going to focus so much on right view at the beginning of these suttas, if you are able to establish some of that right view in yourself, you will find that your meditation becomes much more easy, much more natural. It just happens almost more or less by itself. So what is it that I mean by right view and valuing the right things? Well, what I mean is that when you sit down and try to do your meditation, everyone here will probably find that sometimes you are thinking a lot. Yeah, it's kind of unavoidable. It's part and parcel for what this path is about, or unfortunately, that you think sometimes too much. And the reason why you think a lot is basically because you are valuing the wrong things. What are the things that you are thinking about? Well, you will notice very quickly that the things that you are thinking about are things to do with your work, with your family, with your home, with enjoyment of things in life, whatever it might be. These are the things that you think about. And the reason why you think about those things is because those things are important to you. Right? Of course your work is important to you. Of course your family is important to you. Yeah, and of course, because those things are important to you, you think about them. So what you need to do is you need to reprioritize what really matters. You need to change your values. You need to turn things upside down. And instead, and it is true that, of course, your family and your job will still matter, but you need to have something that matters even more than that. And what matters more than that, of course, is the spiritual path. There's nothing more important than the spiritual path, because this is ultimately the only thing that can secure your happiness and freedom from suffering in the long run. Yes, family and work and home and hobbies and all the things we do in life, yes, these things are important. But they are not really going to get you anywhere in terms of real, profound happiness, etc. That only comes through the spiritual practice. All these other things, they kind of go on and on and on. They change. There are more problems to be solved. And there's more problems waiting behind the problems that you're solving. Always going on. Never finding a solution. Never coming to a goal. And going on from life after life. Never without any kind of end in sight. This is the problem with the worldly kind of values. So instead, we need to shift our values, shift them onto the spiritual path. And when you shift your values onto the spiritual path, that is when the thinking stops. Because there's nothing much to think about when it comes to the spiritual path. Yeah, maybe you think a little bit about, I got to live well, I got to do the right thing, I better keep the 8 precepts. But you don't think too much about those things. They're kind of just natural. They happen, if you like. What we think about are all the things of the world. Those are the biggest problem. So by changing our values, by looking at the world in a new way, we reprioritize. And by that reprioritizing, your mind is leaning in a different direction. And because your mind is leaning in a different direction, it is preoccupied by new things, not preoccupied with those things that block the meditation practice, that make all of this thinking happen in the first place. So, to achieve real peace, it is the idea of valuing things in a new way. This is very fundamental to the whole Buddhist path. And this is why we're going to look at the idea of right view in quite a lot of detail, to see if we can help this shift in view and move it more toward, align it more, in a sense, with the way that the Buddha saw the world. We're going to try to see the world more like the Buddha did. So all of these things, they lead us towards peace. Yeah, and they kind of guide the mind towards the idea of peace. And that peace will then give rise to mindfulness down the track, because the mind is calming down and the clarity will come out of that. So this is one aspect. Yeah, the other aspect, as I mentioned before, is the happiness. It's the joy. It is the idea of well-being, of enjoying what is happening here. And this is equally important. And the reason why it is so important is because if you enjoy what is happening, if you enjoy the meditation, if you enjoy the whole retreat, you will tend to be mindful. Yeah, if this is where you find your happiness, you want to be here. You want to be where you are mindful. So you will be mindful. You want to be where you are happy, I should say. Getting things confused. You want to be where you're happy, because if you're happy, yeah, this is where you want to be. You don't want to fantasize about things. You don't want to think about all the other stuff where you think happiness might be. So the idea of bringing some joy into this whole process actually is fundamental as well. This is the other aspect. So how can we do that on a simple little retreat like this? Bring some happiness in here. And there's a number of things that you can do. And the Buddha talks about this sometimes in the suttas at quite a bit of length. Unfortunately, I have not included that sutta on this retreat. I'm not sure why I haven't. I just kind of put the suttas together fairly fast. They were basically based on a different retreat. So I just kind of whacked them in there. And I think it will be. Sometimes we can't do every sutta on every retreat. But the Buddha does talk about this in quite a bit of length. And we may touch on these things anyway. And one of the first things that I would really recommend you to do there, and that is how you deal with and how you perceive the other people on this retreat. Yeah, this is very important. When you are together with 60 people like we are here now, and we know that sometimes we are going to irritate each other. Yeah, everyone here is irritating. Yeah, we're all irritating and we all get irritated. This is the way the world is. It's impossible not to be irritating sometimes because of different perceptions or whatever have you. So we're all a little bit irritating. And because we are irritating, we have to establish some view of the people around us beforehand so we don't allow the irritation to get the upper hand in our minds. Yeah, and how do we do that? And it's a very simple reflection. And that is to look at all the people who are here and to remember that the people who are here are good people. Yeah, no one who comes on a retreat like this, you don't come here if you're a bad person. There's no point. Why? Well, because here you have to practice kindness, you have to practice morality. You're here to develop yourself. You're here to maybe support others in developing themselves. Everything here is geared towards kindness. Everything here is geared towards something positive. So these are all good people. It's guaranteed that these people are good. And because of that, because of that, all you have to do is to remind yourself of that. So make a very strong, firm view in your mind from the very beginning of this retreat that actually these people around you are really, really good people. And if you have that, and the little so-called irritations that happens during your daily life, the little problems that we have with each other, they will just dissipate because they are important. The big picture that these are good people who are with you is far more important than the small little irritations that happen in daily life. So please keep that in mind throughout this retreat. And if you keep that in mind, I guarantee you, it will be far better retreat as a consequence. So this is number one way of making sure that you have a positive mindset when you sit down and you try to be mindful and the breath is there with you together with that mindfulness. But there's much more that we can do. And the Buddha recommends various kinds of reflections that we can use. And one of those reflections is again the idea of the Kalyana Mitta. Yeah, the Kalyana Mitta is like the good spiritual friend. So it is to rejoice in the spiritual friendship that we have in this world. The spiritual friendship that we have as Buddhists and practicing the Buddhist path is actually very profound. It starts off with the Buddha himself. Yeah, you have the Buddha as your teacher. I don't know if you're able to relate to that idea of having the Buddha as your teacher. But it's kind of amazing to have the greatest spiritual genius in recorded human history. To have that person as your teacher is kind of awesome. Yeah, it's kind of extraordinary. And the more you get this idea that you have the Buddha as your teacher, understanding who the Buddha is, and we're going to do that a little bit by reading this particular suttas, the more you think, wow, this is just astonishing. I'm so fortunate. I've got this incredible person as my teacher. This is a person who has the ability to impart the highest happiness to me. He has the greatest gift he can give to humanity, the highest happiness in the world, the overcoming of all suffering. And this is my teacher. Wow. Yeah, and you feel kind of a sense of uplift. You feel this is just amazing. How come I'm so lucky? I'm so fortunate. You know, and you start to feel a sense of gratitude for having someone like this as your teacher. How did I happen on this? And it's kind of you. Then you become so grateful to the people who may have guided you in this direction. Maybe grateful to your past self, who was thinking carefully and wisely to bring you to this particular point. Yeah, you start to understand that you are in the presence of something really, really astonishing, extraordinary. The Buddha is something really extraordinary in this world. There's nothing like the gem of the Buddha. We're talking about the triple gem. The first of the triple gem is the Buddha himself. Yeah, there's something extraordinary about this. And once you start to understand what is going on, that this is about the very meaning of life, about actually everything we ever wanted in this life, we get on this particular path. Forget about everything else. This is it. Then you start to have a sense of gratitude, a sense of feeling that now you have really found what is important in life. So it starts off with the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha is, for many people, a little bit difficult to grasp because the Buddha seems like a long time ago, seems like it's far away and all of these kind of things. And so sometimes it's easier to think about Kalanamittas as the people who are more present in our life. And that can be the monastic Sangha, for example. And we have a very strong monastic Sangha right here in Perth. We've quite a number of monks here right now. It's really cool to have you here. Thank you for coming. And we're just counting the monks in the monastery yesterday. And there's so many, it's hard to count now. We have recently ordained a couple more monks. And that means one of them is sitting over here, Venerable Dhammadipa, one of the recently ordained monks. And we now have 24 fully ordained monks at Bodhinana Monastery. And we have 7 novice monks. You find over 30 people in brown, right? And you may think that, maybe, I don't know what you think about that, but what you should think, I'm going to tell you what you should think. What you should think is, wow, that is amazing that we have 31 monks right here at Bodhinana Monastery, right? Then we have Dhammasara Monastery, which is kind of, we have three, how many representatives from Dhammasara Monastery? Three? Yeah, okay, four represented, okay. So four, and they have a large community over there. How many monastics have we got over there now? Uncertain. Okay, many. Too hard to count, right? 15? Yeah, about 15, yeah? And it is very rare in the world to find such large monastic sanghas as we have here in Perth. Especially, of course, if you go to Asia, of course you find large sanghas in certain places. But once you're outside of Asia, once you're outside of traditional Buddhist countries, this is very, very unique. This is kind of to be rejoiced in. And it's not just any Sangha. Yeah, there are people like Ajahn Brahm. There are many really well-practiced Sangha members in this community. And it's kind of extraordinary to have something like that in our midst. And so that is also another reason for gratitude. And then you have yourselves, all your companions, all the people are here with you. What a wonderful thing it is that you get such a strong Buddhist community here. 60 people coming together, and some of you I know have come from overseas and from far away, yeah, just to come here to Perth. But most of you are here from Perth. What a wonderful thing it is to have fellow practitioners like this. And once you start to feel this, to understand that support you get from having Kalanamittas in this way, remember the Buddha said that Kalyanamitta, the idea of good friendship, is 100% of the spiritual life, right? It is everything. Without that, there is no spiritual life at all. This is how powerful it is. So start to feel that sense of awe, yeah, how fortunate we all are to have this powerful Buddhist community right here in Perth. In some ways, Perth is at the end of the world, yeah, far, far away from anything else. But in other ways, it is the center of the world because we have such a strong Buddhist community here. Isn't that wonderful? It is very, very powerful. And by thinking like this, by inclining your mind in this kind of direction, you can start to give rise to a bit of joy on the Buddhist path. So this is, there are many other ways, and maybe we'll come back to those later on, but I've already been talking for a long time. So these are kind of the two pillars of meditation practice. On the one hand, you learn to become peaceful by allowing things to be, by not interfering with things, by using the similes of dying, of sitting in the armchair, allowing things to flow, and allowing the peace to build up gradually, gradually, gradually. That's the peace side of things. Yeah, allowing, being the passenger on the train, the beautiful simile that Ajahn Brahm uses. On the other hand, you have the idea of joy and happiness and ease on the path, learning how to enjoy what is going on, directing your mind so you feel positive about what is happening here. You see the good kalanamittas around you and you feel a sense of uplift, even joy in your practice. And then when you sit down, when you get these things right, the peace right and the joy side of things right, these two pillars of meditation, that is when mindfulness can happen. And then when mindfulness emerges from this, then you will find yourself being with the breath. Not watching the breath, not focusing the breath, not attending on the breath, but being with the breath as you are with a good friend. Just hanging out together, not holding on. The feeling is that the breath can disappear at any time. That's okay. You allow the breath to disappear at any time. And then you just wait, and the breath comes back again. And then you are doing the breath meditation without force, without using your intention very much, but allowing the process to develop naturally. And that is the way that mindfulness of breathing should ideally work. So, there you are. Those are just some very basic instructions for you. And of course, during this retreat, you are very welcome to ask questions about this. And there's much, much more that could be said about this, because it's a very vast subject, the idea of meditation practice. But at least it is a kind of an indication for what we're trying to do here in this practice. I wish you all the very best of luck on this retreat, and I hope you have some success in meditation. Please feel free to ask questions. There will be an opportunity to come to personal interviews or to write down questions as we go along. So please do so, and please use this opportunity to the maximum. Remember to enjoy yourself. Remember not to try too hard. If you find that you become tense and not enjoying what is going on, then make sure you take the right measures to enjoy this. Have a cup of tea. Go back and lie down on your bed. Read something. Go for a walk. There's a beautiful bush around here. Use this facilities here to the best, in the best possible way, to make sure that you are enjoying what is going on. It doesn't matter how many hours you meditate. Forget about the number of hours. What matters is that you enjoy what is happening here. Then you are on the right track. Okay, so that is all for tonight. Maybe let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Every evening we're going to do the very simple chanting, the Arahang Samma Sambuddha chanting. And you are don't have to take part in this if you don't like to. But if you want to, you're very welcome to do so. Let's do that now.